Okay, so Snow White, as I know from watching the movie and from reading the book, was the first animated feature with a fully developed character and story. It wasn't the first animated feature, though. I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about some of the early attempts at making animated features by other studios that you go into in the very beginning of this book, because that is fascinating. A lot of people just think of Snow White as being the very first animated feature, but there were others before it.
There absolutely were, and as you know, and this is something that I it's kind of a theme song for me, that when you're dealing with film history, you want to be very, very careful about using the word first. I tell people that in film history, first is the F word, because the minute you identify anything as being the first anything, somebody's going to come up with a precedent. And in this case, sure enough, there were people who made feature-length films before that either were completely animated or had animation in them. What happened, though, and this is something that Walt Disney did more than once, he would come to something like that that already had a precedent, but bring a completely unique and original spin to it, and make such a huge impact with it that people tended to forget it had ever been done before. He completely redefined the concept of what an animated feature would be. And I think that in art, as Edward Vaganek wrote once, it's less important who does something first than who does something best. And in this case, and I don't want to make light of the things that had been done earlier. One of the most important pre-Snow White features is The Adventures of Prince Ahmed, the silhouette animation film made in 1926 by Lotte Reiniger, which is a really charming and impressive, artistically impressive film. But what Walt wanted to do was to actually make an animated film that would move to the center of the movie business arena, that people would actually go to see at a movie house for an evening's entertainment the way they would anything else. And to do that, he came up with a type of story and with some new conventions in producing an animated feature that made such a huge impact that we now take those things for granted. When we think of an animated feature, we think of the model that Walt established with Snow White.
When did he first come up with the idea and present it to his animators at the studio that, boys, we're going to do a feature-length animated film? Because they had been working on these Mickey Mouse shorts and silly symphonies, and there were some of these techniques that we're talking about here trying to breathe life into characters that they were working on. But when did he say, you know what, it's time to take this up to the next level?
Well, this seems to have started gradually. He said later that the idea crystallized in 1933, and in fact, he even talked to some members of the trade press about it in the summer of 1933. But he only gradually broached the subject to his staff during the latter part of the year. And then it was about the middle of 1934 that he and some of the writers started seriously working on developing the story. So he kind of eased into it. And part of it was because, you're right, they had to they were building on the techniques that they had already established. But they really did need to establish some new ones in order, for example, to create a convincing human character who would carry a feature-length story. And that was a tremendously difficult technical problem, and they attacked it from several different angles before they found one that they were satisfied with.
You write in the book about how Walt saw a roadshow showing of the Paramount silent Snow White back when he was living in the Midwest before he went out to California when he was a young boy. Is that what really influenced him, you think, to choose Snow White as his first feature? Or was it more of a kind of, well, Snow White is a universal story type thing?
Well, I think it was actually a combination of both. He commented later that special showing, and we should say that this was a really special showing. It was outside of the usual context of a theatrical showing of a film.
Like thousands of people there, yeah?
Yeah. It was a special movie party that the Kansas City Star staged for the people of Kansas City. at the convention center. So yeah, it did make a big impact on him. But he was inclined to consider all kinds of angles when he undertook a major project. And one of the angles he considered was that he figured the story was the perfect story. It had a sympathetic hero and heroine. It had all kinds of comedy relief built into it. And it provided a perfect showcase for his art, which was the art of the animated film. And I think if it hadn't had all of those factors going for it, he probably would have considered something else instead. But it seems that he really was locked into the idea of Snow White from the beginning of his development of this project.
Well, Disney is very famous for good and ill, in some people's opinion, for sometimes adding happy endings to features or changing stories for modern audiences. How did Walt see the original Grimm Brothers story, and how did it change in going to the screen? What was his thinking in terms of story development?
Well, that was actually a complicated process, and one of the things that really surprised me in working on this book was to discover that there had been a long chain of adaptations before Walt got to the story. I wasn't really expecting to find this, but it turned out that there was a German playwright who was a contemporary of the Grimms who actually came up with a stage adaptation in the mid-19th century, and then from other people basing their ideas on what he had done, there is a practically unbroken line all the way from that adaptation through other stage and film versions to the Paramount film version that Walt saw when he was still a kid in Kansas City. So you can really trace an almost direct hereditary line from the Brothers Grimm to Walt Disney. And in fact, as you say, Walt gets a lot of comment these days for the changes he made in stories, and in fact there are some folklorists who like to beat him up for that. But in fact, when you look at the chain of adaptations, they all kind of left their mark on the Disney film, but along with that, in many cases, he would eliminate some of these extraneous ideas that other people had introduced and deliberately take the story back closer to the Grimm Brothers version. So, in fact, he had more to do with restoring their ideas than he did with changing them in the first place.
And I think he knew his audience, too, because, as you mentioned in the book, he tightened up the story. The queen tries to kill Snow White a few different times in the original story. And in this case, you know, they just kind of bring it down to, okay, the apple in the movie.
Right. That's right. Yeah, he was one of the things that's really, and there are many notable things about this, but what I think is one of the most notable things is that he was a ruthless story editor. They came up with, in the course of working on the film, that some extraordinarily creative minds were at work on this, and they probably came up with enough ideas for 3 or 4 feature-length films. But he was ruthless in trimming them down to a very tight and spare storyline, because he knew the needs of the medium. And sure enough, when you see the film, the story it never seems rushed, but it never seems padded either. It moves along steadily, and the pacing is really beautiful. One of the most famous examples of that is the soup sequence, which a number of Disney fans are familiar with, partly because it was shown in the form of pencil animation on the Disney television program in the 1950s. This was a sequence that was going to show the dwarfs, after Snow White called them in to supper, rushing into the house and slurping their soup like a herd of animals. And so Snow White was moved to try to teach them proper table manners. And it wasn't quite successful, and the sequence was in the works. It was being animated, and everybody loved it and thought it was really hilarious and entertaining in its own right. But Walt was able to look at the big picture and see that the sequence was slowing down the story at a point where they needed to keep it moving. So as difficult as it was, he made the decision that that had to be cut out of the film. And there were other examples of the same kind of thing. In everything that he did, he could see all of the details, but he never lost sight of the big picture.
I love how in the book you go through all the variations of dwarfs. How many dwarfs did Disney go through before finally settling on Sneezy, Happy, Dopey, Sleepy, Doc, Bashful, and Grumpy?
That's very good. That's, you've really got that down. That's I'm impressed. There were more than 50 names considered before they narrowed it down to the 7 that we see in the film. And in fact, one of the things that I got into while working on the book was to look not just at the names, but at some of the traits as they changed as production, as development went along, because to me it's really fascinating to see how these characters gradually develop into not just types but very specific characters. So, for example, Grumpy, he was one of the first and one of the strongest characters in the film, and he was one of the first to be suggested. But he's not just a generic crab, you know. He's a very specific personality, and that is not an accident. They carefully developed him so that he wouldn't just be a type. You get to know him in the course of the film, and he is a distinct individual, and so are the other 6. And to me, that was a big part of the interest in this story. The whole idea of a character that mixes up his words when he talks, that was a trait that was actually passed around to several of the dwarfs before it settled on Doc. And in fact, for a while, Dopey, the one who never talks in the course of the film, at one point he not only talked, but he never stopped talking. He was a real chatterbox. So it's you can really see that they considered every possible way that they could go before deciding on which one was the best.
I think with Dopey, I really see an influence of the great silent comedians in what he's doing as well in that particular character.
There definitely is. And in fact, that was another one of the things that I enjoyed about working on this, because I'll admit it, I'm a movie fan, and I loved being able to relate this to the other film history that was going on at the same time and in earlier times. And yeah, Walt had a real appreciation for the great silent comedians, and you definitely see their stamp on Dopey. Harry Langdon had a big influence on Dopey. I'm sure you're familiar with Langdon. He mm-hmm. was in the silent period. He was a character like nobody else before or since. He was a man who basically looked and functioned like a small child. In fact, James Agee described him as an elderly baby or a baby dope fiend. It's a really kind of odd and unique character, but he left a stamp on Dopey. There are some characteristics that you see in Dopey that come straight from Langdon.
And talk about the real European influence in the film, not just in design, but also what you would think of as camera work.
Well, that was another, for me, really fascinating thing. This whole idea of German expressionism. You don't see very many German silent films of the 1920s without seeing the really marked effect of expressionism. You see a lot of that. You know, the real watershed film for that was The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and then as you know, there were many other German films that reflected that, and it wasn't long before those same German technicians were lured to Hollywood. So expressionism became a very familiar tool in making American films during that time, and it was still around during the 30s. So it's not a surprise that it turns up in Snow White, and one of the best examples is Snow White's flight into the forest when mm-hmm. she's running away from the huntsman. That whole business with running past trees that she imagines as monsters with big hands reaching for her, when in fact it's only the branch of the tree. That's very much a part of that expressionist tradition. The challenge was to do it in animation, and this will show you the subtlety of the craftsmanship in this film. to make it clear that these really were just trees, but that she was imagining that they were monsters reaching for her. Now, that's a very fine distinction to make when you're doing it in the form of drawings, but they pulled it off.
Yeah, and that sequence is the for my kids, who are 5 and 7 and saw the film a couple of years earlier, that's the scariest sequence in the film. It's not the queen or anything like that. It's that sequence.
Yeah, yeah. And it is the case that when there was frightening material in the film, Walt didn't hold back. He pulled out all the stops. And in fact, one of the things that I found interesting also in working on the book was the fact that there were places where the censors didn't want children to see this film unless they were with an adult. The British Board of Censors actually tried to impose what they called an A certificate on the film, so the children could see it only if they were accompanied by an adult. But there was a big outcry about it, and they eventually changed that so that everybody could see it.
That's very interesting. You know, were there always going to be songs in the movie? Because the Silly Symphonies were big. They were based on music, these cartoons that were based on music. And so they had formed a basis for a lot of the training that went into the feature. So they had a hit song with Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf from the Three Little Pigs. Were there always going to be songs in Snow White? And did they think of that in terms of any sort of marketing function at all?
I don't know that Walt thought of it that way to begin with, but it didn't take long before people did start thinking of it in terms of marketing. And yeah, you're right. The success of Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf had a big impact on this because it was the first hit song they had ever had. I believe it was, here I go using the word first, but I believe it was the first hit song to come out of an animated cartoon. And sure enough, it was a big hit in 1933. It was there's any number of recordings that you can find now that were made by jazz bands and singers and a whole range of performers. Well, that wasn't lost on Walt, and in fact, it was just after that happened that he started thinking about making a feature. So and music was always important to him anyway. So I don't find it surprising at all that one of the first things he did was to assign Frank Churchill, the great musician and songwriter who had written Who's Afraid, to come up with some songs for Snow White. One of the big transitions, though, was that there actually had been a few other successful songs from Disney cartoons in the meantime between 1933 and the finish of the feature, but all of them would be considered novelty songs. Snow White kind of passed some kind of marker when it included not only novelty songs, but songs like "Someday My Prince Will Come," that actually were traditional romantic ballads that were that became standards in American popular music. And in fact, that particular song was one of the first ones written for the film. Churchill composed that song late in 1934 when they were really just getting serious about developing the story.
It's a beautiful song, and I mean, there's so many great jazz arrangements of it. Miles Davis, one of my favorites. So,
yeah, yeah, that's and see, I think that's an indication of just how durable and timeless Churchill's music is, because that whole business of modern jazz arrangements, if I'm not mistaken, that started with Dave Brubeck in 1957. So a full two decades after the film was made. And then you're right, yeah, Miles Davis was one of the ones who came along and did another really outstanding performance of it too. So everything about this film has such artistic integrity and timelessness that it can be adapted in many ways. I think that's a great example.
What was probably the most surprising thing you found in the archives at Disney while you were researching for the book?
Oh, boy. I think there were any number of things, but one of the ones that really sticks in my mind the most is what they were going to do with that song, "Someday My Prince Will Come." As you know, in the film, Snow White basically just sits in a chair and sings the song, and it's beautiful. It works just fine. But for a long time, they were considering having kind of a dream version of that, where she would start to sing the song, and then you would see her in kind of a dream vision in the clouds and dancing through the clouds with the prince. And as they started to develop that idea, it got more and more elaborate until you had really spectacular cloudscapes and stars, and it got to be really elaborate visuals. And in fact, we were fortunate enough to be able to reproduce some of those paintings and sketches in the book, in The Fairest One of All. So it got to be so elaborate that Walt decided that the song itself wouldn't carry the sequence. So one of the things they did was hire Kathleen Millay, who was the younger sister of Edna St. Vincent Millay and a successful poet in her own right, to write a spoken verse that Snow White would speak at some point during this sequence. And so, sure enough, Kathleen Millay was on the studio payroll for several months and contributed to that and other parts of the film. And then in the end, they didn't use a word that she wrote, not because it was no good, but because they ultimately decided that it would be better to forget about this fantasy concept and stick with the more basic performance of the song. So I think that was one of the more surprising things that I found, was just this whole, almost a whole separate sequence that would have made the overall film into something very different from what we know today, and ultimately wasn't used.
What is it that you personally love about Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs?
Oh, let me count the ways. I think that, for me, there's something really golden about the Walt Disney Studio in the 1930s. The Mickey Mouse and Silly Symphony series, for me, I mean, I love the whole field of classic Hollywood studio animation. But for me, there's something really, really special about the Disney shorts of the 1930s. There's just this tremendous explosion of creativity that went on during that decade. And for me, Snow White is the perfect culmination of that. All of the great things that they had developed really came to kind of a crowning fruition in Snow White. And that includes both the technical things, like their use of color and the multiplane and so on, but also the art of character animation, personality animation is what they called it. They really had developed that to such a level of perfection that it's never really been improved on since then. And I think Snow White, again, was kind of the crowning glory of that development in animation.
Is this book, The Fairest One of All, going to be, I guess, hopefully the first in a long series of books from the Walt Disney Family Foundation in terms of historical tomes about the classic films?
Well, we hope so. We hope so. We've got plans to do all kinds of books like that about various aspects of Disney history. In fact, I'm working on another one now about the making of Pinocchio, which is also a pretty fascinating thing, and it's going to take a while to get it finished. But we're not just going to walk through all of the features like that. There are various other kinds of topics that I think will lend themselves well to this publishing program. So hopefully, yes, this is the first of many.
Good, good. Yeah, there's beyond the films, there's lots of stuff having to do with the television work, I think would be terrific, and even a book about Walt Disney and the space program, I think would be amazing sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that when he was just a man of endless enthusiasm and endless curiosity. Diane Disney Miller, who is the head of the Walt Disney Family Foundation, she said that if we confine our exhibits at the museum to the things that Walt Disney was interested in, we'll never run out of material because he was interested in everything. So, everything he touched, he would get fascinated and he would start exploring. So, yeah, those TV programs about space exploration are a really good example. They've become legendary since then.
Well, J.B. Kaufman, thank you very, very much today.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, and thank you for the opportunity.